This is F1 Debrief. He's been the voice of reason this season. Coming up on this show, we discuss the oh-so-long Canadian GP, overly cautious safety cars, wheel-banging teammates, plus a book and an app.
Has the race finished yet?
Yeah.
Is it still going? Well, is Byrne still running round and round and round in that safety car? Has anybody told him it's over?
It was raining in Canada.
And is it still raining in Canada?
We had to red flag our podcast as well.
For 168 hours.
Yeah.
It's a whole week late.
You know, Martin Brundle may still be wittering on.
Is he still? I think he might be.
Good week, bad week.
It's been a good week for Lewis Hamilton because he got to swap cars with NASCAR star Tony Stewart for a drive around the Watkins Glen International Circuit. It was a bit damp, but they both enjoyed it. Apparently, Stewart said that driving the car made him realise why overtaking is so difficult in F1 because the braking distances are small compared to other series.
Overtaking is difficult? Overtaking is difficult? Has nobody told Tony about Formula 1 in 2011?
He hasn't been watching.
We have DRS now. Overtaking is easy.
It's been a bad week for Nico Rosberg, who has spent all year making himself look fit and growing beards and stuff to shake off the tag of Britney. But he must have gone a bit too far because the artist in Montreal, who was commissioned to draw pictures of each driver to go above their garages in the pit lane, yeah, he made him look like a werewolf.
That's what happens when you grow your beard too long.
Yeah.
There's a warning for you, kids.
It's been a good week for the people waiting to see Richard Branson in a stewardess outfit, whoever these crazy people
are. It's never going
to
happen.
He made an appearance in the Montreal paddock and was saying that he'd agreed to swim across the Irish Sea at the end of August, despite having hurt his leg, which is why the charity flight had been put on hold. But Branson admitted, "I can't say I'm swimming the Irish Sea and then say I'm not able to put on a stewardess's uniform. I've given Tony a date when I'm in Australia to see if that works."
Right. I'm already so very, very bored of this subject now. It's not even going to be funny when it comes around to doing it, is it? It's just so out of date. I'm over it.
The goodwill is ebbing away the longer it drags on. It's been a bad week for a man from Bournemouth who spent a long time and a lot of money trying to conquer his fear of flying, including therapy and anti-anxiety drugs and all that. To reward himself for beating the phobia, he booked a trip to the Monaco GP, but he was banned from getting on the plane because his passport was a bit bent in one corner. The staff wouldn't budge. How awful is that?
I'll tell you what, I used to fly with a washed passport. Because it'd been in the wash, it was all dog-eared and useless, basically, as a passport. This was pre-2001, and you could do that. You could fly around with any old passport, with any old picture. It wasn't a problem. And I even learnt the international sign for us. I'm sorry, it got washed.
It's been through the washing machine.
You do the tumble dryer kind of hand signals. You can't get away with that anymore, sadly. Sign of the times.
News and views.
So it's been a couple of weeks since we did a show, and there has been quite a lot of news in that time. But at the same time, nothing has changed. So, for instance, the Lotus versus Lotus thing happened, but nothing changed.
Mm-mm.
The ruling didn't really favour either of them.
Nope.
We also had the Bahrain Grand Prix. That got reinstated, then it got taken away again.
Reinstated, then uninstated.
Yeah.
Back to square one.
Yeah. So that nothing has changed there either.
Right. So when you say lots of news has happened, nothing really to talk about.
Well, the only thing that came out of it was a 21 race calendar.
Yes. This every year we say Formula One has too many races, and every year it gets one race longer.
Yeah.
How long are they going to keep this up for?
2012 is 21 races.
And apparently, even though the FIA announced this provisional calendar, they immediately retracted it and said, actually, it almost certainly will not be 21 races, really. We were just joking, Gov.
We don't know which one's going to not be there, but it won't be 21. Then why did you say it?
Also, there's one race with an asterisk beside it, that's Turkey. So therefore, how can you say, we're not sure which one it is? But there's only one that's even possibly in doubt.
It might be that Turkey.
It does look like next year is going to be a very, very long season.
Yeah.
Because I don't trust John Todd when he says there won't be 21. I think if Turkey stumped up the money and Bahrain sorts its business out, its problems out, there could easily be a 21 race calendar because everybody has this date. And if everybody actually comes up, you know, with the money and everybody has the facilities ready, if Austin is ready and there's nothing to say that it won't be, that's 21 races and you've just got to fit them in.
Yeah. I wrote a post on Side Podcast that, I mean, I basically said,
and your post,
it's too many. I mean, when we started Side Podcast, it was about 16 or 17 races a year and it's crept up to 19. And this year should have been 20, but without Bahrain, it's 19. We've never watched more than 19 races in a year. And suddenly it's going to be 21. And that is half the available weekends in a year. 52 weeks in a year, 21 of them.
That's a lot of
will
that's
be
saying
Formula
goodbye
One.
To a lot of Sundays. That's a lot of nice weather we're not going to see because we're indoors watching the TV. Now, Canada, when the race at Canada, did you notice it went on a bit too long?
Yeah.
It went on so long that we missed the end of it. We had to give up during the red flag period, and we didn't see it. So I caught the race, I think, on Wednesday evening. I caught it time delay, time shifted. It was the first time I think I've watched the race time shifted before, because usually if I don't care about the race, I either don't watch it or I do watch it live, and that's it. With the F1 timing app, I was able to time shift the live timing for the first time ever as well, which is fantastic.
That's useful.
It's essential. If you're going to watch Formula One after the fact, you definitely need the F1 timing app. It is rather, rather good in that situation. So I watched it. I watched the race in my own time. And it wasn't terrible. It wasn't an awful way, awful thing to do. I knew the result, which was a shame, but that was the only downside to it.
Well, the only other downside is that obviously our podcast is a week late because you hadn't seen the race.
Well, that is true. But I think it might work well for next year, whereby we say, okay, we're going to watch 16 races live. But the remainder of the races, however many that may be, we're going to watch in our own time when it suits us.
I can't wait for the business meeting we have when we have to decide which ones we're going to skip. That's going to be fun.
Yes. I mean, you're going to say, okay, well, we're going to watch the first one. Can't miss that. But then there's races like the one that's coming up is Valencia. Always a boring race.
Mm-hmm.
Easily missable. We're not at a crucial point in the championship. Not that bothered. So it depends, really. But the other thing that I might do also for the coming Valencia Grand Prix is, as qualifying becomes less and less relevant, I'm thinking this week I'm not going to be watching qualifying. So all I'm really trying to do is experiment and find out how to reduce the amount of time Formula One takes out of my life. Because it's clearly going to take more and
Bernie's
more and more every year.
Bernie's trying to pile it in, so you're trying to whittle it down.
Well, I have to, yeah. If there were six races a year, we would obviously put more effort into those six races, and we could cover those six races in the best way imaginable. And we'd have podcasts, and we'd have competitions, and we'd have quizzes and all sorts of great stuff if there was only six races a year. Because there's so many races, we still have the same amount of time to dedicate. Our time, we can't magic more time out of it. We still have jobs and we still have money to earn and we have other hobbies and other interests. So all I'm trying to do is establish what's essential in order to keep doing side podcasts. What can we discard while still enjoying it? Because whereas last year, wasn't really into Formula One, didn't really want to watch it, wasn't behind it at all. This year I'm loving it.
Yeah.
But we've got to work out what we can miss, what we can afford to miss, in order to still enjoy it and still keep doing what we do.
But also I said in the post that it's very lucky because obviously we both like Formula One and we both watch a lot of it.
Mm.
But for other people who have to convince their families who don't care about cars, that's...
Goodness me, yeah. By the way, 21 this year. How's that going to work out?
Yeah.
Not good.
It's awkward.
And the thing is, if it's 21 this year, it'll be 22 next year, 23 the year after. It's going up. It won't stop until the Bernie's run out of offers and run out of venues to host it. And if somebody offered you £25 million to host a race, you'd find a way to host it, wouldn't it? If someone said, here's £25 million, can I have a Formula One race? You'd find a way to make that happen.
Put one in my garden.
Absolutely. And anybody, the problem is we're not getting any of that £25 million. That's why we're
You want
it.
A cut of Bernie's money.
It would make me happier about the situation, yes.
There actually was a tiny little bit of news that does change things quite significantly. Virgin Racing fired Nick Wirth. Or parted company with him, although they still don't seem to have publicly admitted it yet.
I'm in a bad mood about this.
Are you?
I'm really rather annoyed at Virgin because as a small team, they have been more open with fans and they've been more interactive and things like that on social media. And
excellent on Twitter.
They've done some great things. Before every race now, they get fans' opinions about the city. So if you're local to Canada. They canvass for opinions about Canada, about Montreal, and they put together before the race and they take all the fans' opinions and make a play, things to think, see and do in Canada according to Formula One fans. That's great. I love the way that they're bringing social media into that. However, they only appear to be comfortable using social media for good news because as soon as they got some bad news to announce, it all goes very quiet down their way.
Yeah. But the news didn't even appear on their website. See, the only place I've...
Denial. What it is.
The only place I've seen it is... on Autosport and various other news sites where they said some people from Virgin have told us. Now, that's not a statement, is it?
No, it's the worst possible way to announce bad news. It was late at night. It was a quiet word they had with Autosport. I don't know if it even appeared in their print magazine. It was online. It was on their website. And they said, we've heard from Virgin that Nick Wirth is gone. And they had a quote from somebody to confirm that. And to me, that's not the way you want to treat your fans because... The thing with Virgin and Nick Wirth, the CFD, whatever you call it, a concept, was the thing about Virgin. In the same way that, Ferrari are Italians and they've got this, long Formula One history. Virgin are all about reinvented Formula One without using an expensive wind tunnel. They're keeping their costs low and they're doing it differently, and that's fantastic. And we're, you know, this is what we're focusing on. This is the only interesting thing about Virgin is the fact that they don't use a wind tunnel. And when they've suddenly decided to drop Nick Worth and they've dropped the whole concept, they dropped the only thing that was interesting about them.
Signed up with a wind tunnel or two?
Well, yeah, that's what's going to happen in the future. I think they've got loads of ads. They've got ads for jobs now in the motorsport press this week. They're going to be looking for more experienced people with, I would assume, traditional values. And yet they don't have the balls to say to the fans, you know, it didn't work. We tried it. We tried the Nick Worth route. It turns out we're slower than HRT. Things are not looking good for us. We're going to change something. This is what we're going to change. None of that. They don't have the wherewithal to come out and say that to the fans. And personally, I find that slightly offensive.
Which is completely opposite to Williams, who said, things aren't working. We're looking at reshuffling. Mm. These people are leaving.
Yes, I don't agree with what Williams did in terms of bringing Mike Coughlan into the team.
No, that's, but they were open about it.
They were open about it. They did everything correct in terms of announcing what happened. They didn't shy away from questions. They didn't run away from the fans. And they embraced social media in that respect. And I'm so disappointed that...
We're still waiting for Virgin to get back to you, aren't we?
I hassled them on Twitter and they said, oh, we're busy at the moment.
It's qualifying. We'll get back to you. It's a week later.
Because they haven't got an answer to it. The answer... I mean, there was like I forget what the exact tweet was, but it was like, thanks for all the comments. Now we're going racing. Right. Thanks for all the comments about what exactly? You know, you're acknowledging that people are tweeting you about, you know, what's going on? Have you fired Nick Worth? Haven't you fired Nick Worth? What happened? Why was the decision made? And they're just denying it. And it's a bit sad, really.
And the other bit of team movements is that Steve Nielsen has resigned from Renault.
Mm. Which is a shame because he was the best thing about the Renault podcast.
It's pretty much all I know about him is that he's good on the podcast.
He's fantastic on the Renault podcast, but Renault have gone away from that concept recently, and the latest podcast has diminished in quality of late for whatever reason, and it seems to be some poorly edited interviews and nothing more. So it's not like we're really losing him.
No, that's true.
And he might end up somewhere else where we hear more from him. It's a shame. He's a knowledgeable guy. He got some great insight into Formula One. Hasn't ever been the same since Pat Simmons left. So it'll be interesting to see where he turns up. Pat's obviously at Virgin, and Bob Bell's going to Mercedes. So we'll see which route he follows.
Qualifying.
Ahead of qualifying, free practice was littered with crashes. Even Vettel found his way into the wall of champions.
Yes, it was one of those weekends. And Montreal has had a habit of doing this in the past. Obviously, it's not a track that gets used throughout the year. It's a street track. They close the, you know, public roads. They close the roads. It's a bit like Albert Park. And the lack of grip does catch drivers unaware. A lot of carbon fibre was flying around that circuit on Friday.
After free practice one, Sergio Perez, he said he didn't feel very well, so Sauber had to replace him.
What do you make of that?
Well, it's weird, is what it is. A lot of people were saying he was stupid because... obviously it was going to lower him in the team's estimation, although apparently that didn't happen. I think perhaps it was Eddie Jordan was saying, I don't know, someone was saying...
You're quoting Eddie Jordan?
No, not necessarily, that they'd actually thought better of him for being honest and saying, I don't feel well. Better that than crashing the car or anything like that. And other people were saying that he was very brave for standing up and admitting, you know, that he wasn't feeling well, even though he'd passed all the checks and anything. So... Either way, I don't really know. I mean, if he didn't feel well, then that's fine. But it is weird that he seemed fine.
Yes. Yeah. And the thing is, after a big accident like that, then you do want some recovery time. What concerned me more was the way the team conveniently shoved Pedro de la Rosa back into the spare seat.
Well, yes. For something that was so very last minute, and Pedro said he had 10 minutes warning, but he did already know it could happen. Mm-hmm. So they had been planning. They had his seat ready and stickers and everything. Now, he had to go in his McLaren overalls into the Sauber car, which was a bit weird.
Yep.
But they obviously had that as a backup plan. But he's not their reserve driver.
No, he isn't. No. Gloria Estefan is.
Yes.
And he wasn't too happy discovered that the third driver role had gone to Pedro de la Rosa. Yeah. He discovered it via Twitter.
Yeah, well, he certainly tweeted about it saying, I was ready, I didn't know about this. There were reports that he was back in Mexico taking exams or racing somewhere else.
Is that true? I thought somebody was joking about the exams.
I don't know what is the truth there. And also, there's a lot of discussion about the fact that Peter Sauber said they wouldn't have promoted him into the car anyway because he's not ready for Formula One. So then why have him as your reserve driver? Mm-hmm. Why not have someone that is ready
if the guy
to go in the
isn't
car?
Ready, then that is the fault of Sauber because they are not running him on Fridays.
Yeah.
You've seen Lotus run several drivers. You've seen Virgin run
That's how they made
drivers. Toro Rosso run spare Friday drivers.
It's how Paul de Resta became ready. Mm. It's because he was run on Fridays all the time last year.
That is what should be happening at Sauber, and that's a major failing on their part if their reserve driver isn't ready. Because in actual fact, if he's not ready to drive in a Grand Prix, he isn't a reserve driver, is he?
He's just a guy.
That's all he is. And when he what are they going to do to make him ready? Because as long as he sits on the sidelines, he's not gaining more experience.
You couldn't get further opposites than that. Someone that has no experience and Pedro who has a lot of experience.
Well, that's true. But the thing is, Sauber brought Vettel in to Formula One, didn't they? They ran him on Fridays. Was it Sauber? I'm sure it was.
BMW.
So they have experience in bringing young drivers in with a tiny amount of experience and trusting them to be run. I don't know what's going on there. You just have to assume that at the moment they don't have a third driver because is what they have. He's just not, you know, he's not capable of standing in. Sergio has now said he's coming back for Valencia and he said he's fine this time, and that may well be the case. But if he's not, you're going to have to assume it's Pedro who's going to get the nod again.
Yeah, but I mean, what is in it for McLaren to be loaning out their third driver all the time?
Money, I should imagine. Sauber ran the sponsorship, didn't they? Ran Santander sponsorship, I would assume. I'm not sure there is much in it for McLaren other than the fact that they have a third driver who's capable of being a third driver. And, you know, that maybe they're a standout team this year.
They're nice enough to loan him out.
They're nice enough to loan him out, and they've got somebody who genuinely has experience.
Qualifying itself is it's actually a bit of a blur for me. It was quite a long time ago. I'd imagine that Vettel got pole. The only thing that stands out from it is that Jerome D'Ambrosio didn't qualify in the Virgin car.
Mm-hmm.
But he was outside the 107% time, but they still let him race. The FIA thought about it for a while and they decided, no, we'll let him race because he was in a spare chassis or something after a crash. So he wasn't used to it. I don't know, the setup was wrong, whatever. Why? What's the point of having a rule that says if you set a time outside this, you can't race, and then saying, actually, no, we'll let you race. It's fine. Don't worry about it. You can speed up later.
Beyond that, it's actually worse than that. Yes, this leniency is a problem. And if there is a rule, they should stick by it.
We've seen people be let in before if they'd had a crash and they'd set a fast time earlier.
Yeah.
But he hadn't even done that.
Well, he'd set a time, I think, on Friday that was within it. So that was the reason. There was one point when he just about managed to dip under that limit. The problem Virgin have is they've given up development due to the fact they've fired the guy who was doing their development for this year. So their car's not going to get any quicker. Red Bull's car, potentially,
could continue to get
quicker and quicker and quicker. Well, there is a diffuser change coming. There's a change to the regulations coming for Silverstone, which may slow down the Red Bulls. If it doesn't do that, if it doesn't make any difference to the qualifying time, and the field continues to get more and more competitive as Virgin stand still, they're going to be outside the 107% rule more and more.
The 107% thing hasn't been an issue for the last couple of races. And when it was always HRT that were a problem. But now they've improved enough.
Great guns. Considering they have such a minuscule budget by comparison. And I think it was it Elisa in the comments said that she was talking to the designers of the HRT recently. And they said this year they didn't design the car for anything specific. They just designed the car to look like other Formula One cars. And that's the limit of their development.
The general shape.
Does it look like a Formula One car? That'll do. And there it is, beating the Virgin team. And also, it finished. Both HRTs finished ahead of the Paul Lotuses in Canada. So they're doing incredibly well. It's just that Virgin are not doing well enough.
The race. We are going to talk about the race, the bits and pieces that we managed to cobble together at different times, watching when we could.
The bits you remember.
Yeah, but before we do that, we have a voicemail from Sandy, who is actually at the track. It's a little bit long, 4 minutes or so, I think, but it's worth listening to all of it because he was there, so he knows exactly how it all played out.
Hi, Side Podcast. This is Sandy with an MP3 from Canada. I was at the race yesterday in Montreal, and I'm still drying out and recovering from all of the insanity and chaos that was the Montreal Grand Prix. It was a fantastic race and an incredible roller coaster of emotions going there and being in the stands. But really, the race was something else. We got there early and caught the driver's parade, which was the drivers going around in these little convertible cars sitting on the back. And I have to say, I am so happy that Alonso is carrying on the tradition of wearing an enormous Ferrari hat. This tradition was started by Kimi Raikkonen, my previous favorite in the sport. And now that Alonso's taken his spot, he's taken on that mantle, and I think it looks great. Anyway, it was raining on and off just before the start, but as the where they would be doing their warm-up lap, the rain had stopped, and it was even looking good. So we were pretty disappointed that the race did start under a safety car, because we were on turn, the first main corner there, complex, or really around turn three. And we felt we'd be deprived of an interesting start, but thank you to Mark Webber for spinning out and causing some excitement right in front of us. That was to be just the beginning of the day's excitement. We then had got to see Alonso being kicked out by Button, and then he took out Lewis as well. From where we were, all we saw was Lewis cut the corner on the first or second corner there, and then get a puncture, and we thought he'd done it to himself, but thanks to the replay, we saw that it was a good old Button. Then the rain started. Lots of safety cars. And then finally, they red flagged it, and we decided to make a dash to go under the grandstand and wait it out. Spent about an hour waiting in the rain. Finally made the call that it looked so dark and gloomy, and we were so uncomfortable and wet, to leave. We'd got about halfway around the circuit towards the metro station when I checked on my portable device. I checked the Factbyte, Factbox, etc., and Twitter, and saw that there was the rain had stopped. We noticed it did, as we'd taken some shelter then, and they might restart. So we went back, got back to our seats. The rain did stop. The sun came out, and then we had this incredible restart. It felt like a whole new Grand Prix, a second chance. And my jaw was dropped the whole time. Kobayashi, one of my favorites, in second place, having not pitted, was able to change his tires. And I was really hopeful that Kobayashi would make it onto the podium. That wasn't to happen. Then there was a Heidfeld spectacular crash, his car seeming to just eat his front wing and going off into a runoff area. I'm glad he was okay. Lots of action. And then it seemed that Michael Schumacher was making a run for the win, and we were very excited. Looking at the lap times on our devices, we could see that he was faster even than Vettel and catching up. That wasn't to be. Button pulled it off after coming back from very far at the back, taking the podium. We ran down the bleachers during the last lap because we wanted to get to the podium. And I just barely caught Vettel spinning out and Button taking the lead. Got right up there, saw Button celebrate on the podium. An incredible race. I absolutely loved the Montreal Grand Prix. It felt like at least two races packed in there. They do a great job. The crowd was really full. They hated the safety cars, but we all really loved the action.
Oh, what a fantastic voicemail from Sandy.
Excellent
love
work.
That. I will dispute the fact that Mark Webber span out. Because he didn't spin out at all. He was pushed out.
Was he?
But we'll get to that in a minute.
Yes. So, yeah, the race started behind a safety car. The track was a bit wet. It's always disappointing when it starts behind a safety car.
Now, you've ranted about this in the past. This is something you do not like this.
Well, I just think, just wait.
It's always anticlimactic to start behind a safety car because you don't have the lights and the cars just sort of peel off from the grid. And you don't get that initial rush. And Formula One needs that. It does. You do need this, like, bang, and we're off. And I can't see that it would have hurt to do a sighter lap for all the cars to go out on the initial lap and just go around slowly and then decide. Because throughout the Grand Prix, I feel that the organisers erred on the side of caution way too much. They brought out the safety car and the red flag period before the heavy rains hit. And they brought out the safety car at the start when it was majorly unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because obviously we weren't there. And we talked to Joe this week and he said the conditions there were necessary. And he actually agrees with everything the safety car people did. But I just think, I don't know, safety car to me is there to slow the cars when there's an accident, mm-hmm. and the race is going. So you don't want to stop what's already happened.
Yep.
And it's, but it's already going. You need to make sure that they don't go too fast, all that kind of thing. It's not there so that you can try and sidestep the weather. No. The weather is what it is. So deal with it. Either race or don't.
Yes.
But don't try and pretend.
And if the Formula One cars are not capable of racing in the rain, redesign the Formula One cars.
Yeah.
This is, we have this problem. We laugh at NASCAR. NASCAR, every time the slightest drop of rain lands on the track, they peel the cars in and that's it for the racing. Until the rain's gone, because those cars cannot run on an oval in that, in those weather conditions. An IndyCar can. IndyCars can run on an oval in pretty much all conditions, unless it's absolutely torrential. And that, I love that about IndyCar, and I love that NASCAR is just considered very pathetic, because it can't, you know, they've got windscreen wipers and they still can't race in the rain. And I just wish Formula One was more manly about it. I wish they just could have cars that were capable, you know, raise the ride height, whatever you have to do to get the cars out, make better wet tires. If that's the problem, maybe nobody trusts the Pirelli wet tires. In that case, what you need is more testing.
For me, it's just either do it or don't do it. It's like the whole red flag thing. So they stopped the race because it was raining too heavily. Fair enough. I don't necessarily disagree with that. You can't race through torrential rains like that. But then it's like, we're just going to wait 10 minutes, then we're going to send this car out, and then wait a bit more, we're going to send it out every 10 minutes. Don't do that. Just say, okay, we'll give it an hour and we'll come back in an hour and see it then, because then we can go off and do something else and come back. We don't have to sit for 10 minutes going, is it there yet? Is it there yet?
Well, I do come back to the point, which is there's a 2-hour limit on a Grand Prix, but for some unimaginable reason, it stops when the red flag comes out. Now, I do not understand why the clock stops ticking because the red flag's out, because, I mean, the time limit's still ticking down. The whole point of the time limit is that there are satellite windows and there are schedules on television, and people have other stuff to do. And if you're not going to adhere to your actual limitation, why have it at all?
Mm.
What is the point of a 2-hour limit that only remains valid when the circuit remains dry?
Yeah.
And clear.
It's just, it's hard. It's hard to know what they should do, because you don't want to, that obviously motorsport has a risk, we know all that, but you don't want to be sending them out there in ridiculous conditions. But at the same time, there has to be a limit to how long you can test people's patience at home.
There should be some kind of rule that says, unless two cars have crashed out due to wet weather, don't bring the safety car out. And when it comes out, bring it in early and see if anybody else crashes. The safety car was out for so long after the red flag finally came in that nobody, well, almost immediately, half the grid came in and swapped to Inters.
Yeah.
Because the dry line was that dry.
Yeah.
So clearly nobody trusts these wet tyres.
It's also, I don't think it's very helpful to hear when they're going round and round behind the safety car and the people who it's advantageous for are going, no, we don't want to race, stop it, stop it. And everyone, like Lewis Hamilton and stuff, as we've seen previously, and they're like, we want to race, we want to race. I don't think that helps people at home.
The point of having a safety car with Bern Maelander driving the damn thing is that he can judge the conditions. You should not be asking the opinion of drivers who have points riding on the race, calling the shots whether or not it should run. We saw the same in Korea, and exactly the same thing happened, and it's a completely farcical to do that. It's ultimately not fair on anybody.
We had quite a few voicemails about the race, so let's hear another one. This is from Simon.
Hello there, it's Simon. It's lap 25 of 70 and the red flags are out. DC and Martin are jabbering onto each other and it's looking a little bit soggy out there. Is it wrong that I pitched a moan 2 weeks ago when Seb changed his tyres under red flags, but now I'm getting completely overexcited that Kobayashi will have some fresh grooves and being sat in second place? Go Kobe. That's if we ever get going again. Okay, bye.
I must quickly say that after the race had finished, after the 4 hours worth of whatever was going on, he sent me a quick email and said, hi, Christine, I left an answer phone message just as the red flags went out. In the message, I said DC and Martin were jabbering on. Can I retract that? 2 hours later, and they've done an amazing job keeping us all interested. In hindsight, jabbering on may have been a little disrespectful.
They were jabbering, but it was fun jabbering. It was a highlight, I think. Tweets from the teams, tweets from motorsport fans, and the commentary kept us entertained. We weren't bored at all during the red flag period. The only problem was we were running out of time.
Yeah, it's frustrating when you can keep yourself entertained with the brilliant community and seeing what the teams are saying, but ultimately you want to see racing.
Hi guys, it's Nathan, long time listener, first time MP3 sender. I enjoyed the race. I thought it was really, really good. Very exciting up until the last lap was. Really disappointed that Kobayashi couldn't get a podium. because he was running in second for so long, and I was really, really happy for him. But basically, I want to talk a little bit about DRS and how disappointed I was with the double usage of it, I guess. I think it made passes really too easy at the end, especially when Webber and Button were overtaking Schumacher. I don't think it's right that a 7-times world champion can't even defend his position, you know, having got there through his ability in the wet and through his skill, and it really undermined the race. It just doesn't appeal to me, and I was really, really disappointed by the way it was used in this race.
That's two people who are rooting for Kobayashi there. He was in a good position, but ultimately he didn't have a fast enough car to make it happen. And this is where I disagree with Nathan, because I don't think the double DRS made that much of a difference. On the one hand, I agree, if you're going to have two usage zones, there should be two activation zones. It was very odd seeing a car pass, make a clean pass during the first zone, and then also get the extra bonus when he got to the second zone. But because there was a lack of a second activation zone, the guy he passed never had a chance to come back at him. So double DRS, it was a trial at Canada, didn't work out. It definitely needed double DRS, needs double activation. However, I loved DRS in Canada. I really thought it made the race. For the first time this year, tyres weren't an issue. Tyres didn't come into the equation. They didn't degrade. We didn't have the situation where you have to run two compounds. People just ran the best tyre they could. And nobody really suffered tyre degradation issues. Therefore, all of this race was about DRS. And in the situation with Schumacher got to where he was by great driving and fantastic, you know, good to see him up there. It really was. I was quite impressed by Schumacher's drive. However, he was in the slower car, and the slower car was holding up the faster cars. And this has been Formula One's problem since aero became an issue. Slower cars create a train, and faster cars cannot pass. In the situation with Schumacher, you had Schumacher leading Webber, leading Button. And in that case, Webber has a Dickey Kurz system. It's not very powerful, and it doesn't work very often. But Jenson Button and Michael Schumacher both have the Mercedes Kurz system, and therefore they're equal. So that cancels each other out, apart from the fact the choice of where to use it is the only variable in that situation. So you've got Kurz against Kurz, like for like. So you in that race, you can discount Kurz. So it's not tyres. And it's not Kurz. And therefore, all of that racing came down to DRS. And the DRS allowed Jenson Button to pass Michael Schumacher. And when he did, he scurried off into the distance. And Michael Schumacher never saw him again.
So I have a question. I must say, because I watched bits and pieces as the race was live, and I never watched it back again because I'd seen all the good stuff. I saw the end and, mm-hmm. and all that. So I sort of missed the intricacies of the DRS and the strategies and that, but I did pick up all the important bits. So my question is then, if the DRS freed up Button to go chasing after Vettel, if that hadn't happened, would Schumacher have been able to chase after Vettel?
He didn't have a fast enough car. Vettel was fast enough to keep the gap. And therefore, the only person who could challenge Vettel was Jenson Button. Even Mark Webber didn't have a fast enough car. Even though he was in basically the same chassis, he didn't have a fast enough car to make that happen. I think when Webber got past Schumacher, he didn't make that much headway. Schumacher didn't come back at him, but there wasn't a big gap appearing.
Schumacher was probably like, oh, forget it by
and
then.
Fair enough. You know, yeah, he might feel like that. And I know a lot of Formula One fans after the race, I got the impression that they didn't like the fact that Schumacher was doing well, but then got beaten by DRS. But he wasn't in a genuinely fast enough car to be in that position. The car just wasn't quite good enough. And that's, we don't want to see him defensively driving it and keeping everybody behind him, because defensive driving isn't fun to watch. And the other thing, the last point I wanted to make about DRS is on the final lap, Sebastian Vettel threw his car off the road and allowed Jensen past. After the race, Vettel said, "The reason I was pushing so hard was because I knew as soon as Jenson Button got behind me into the DRS activation zone, I was toast." Okay? So he was dead panicked that Jenson Button would get close enough, because he knew once he got close enough, he was going to go sailing past him. So he was pushing harder and harder and harder to make sure there was a big enough gap before he got to the DRS zone, and then he threw it off the road. If you enjoyed that last lap of the Canadian Grand Prix, and I don't think anybody listening to this podcast would say they didn't enjoy that last lap. Even Vettel fans must agree it was a fantastic finish to a Grand Prix. If you enjoyed it, you enjoyed it because of DRS. Because if it wasn't for DRS, Jenson Button wouldn't be where he was. Sebastian Vettel wouldn't have been as panicked as he was. And he would have just cruised to an easy victory. Well, one other thing, must add, Felipe Massa passed Kobayashi on the line.
Yeah.
So close. Such
Photo
a close finish. Again, down to DRS. DRS that allowed him to get so close. It was the second use of the DRS, I think, that pushed him past. Probably, if Vettel hadn't chucked it off the road, I would guess that the Vettel-Button fight would have come down to that. It could have got that close. And then we would have had the closest finish in Formula One ever, thanks to DRS. So I love it. I really do. I think that race alone, that situation, when you take tyres out of the equation, you take curves out of the equation, it was just about DRS, and it made that race as awesome as it was.
Like you say, Button made his way past Vettel, took the win. So that is another one that Vettel hasn't won. Yay! I mean,
second of the season.
I don't necessarily wish him bad results, but it's always good to see someone else winning. So that's two McLaren drivers have managed to win a race. Amazing.
And not Webber.
No. We had another voicemail from Button's biggest fan.
Hi, Side Podcast. It's Lou. I'm just trying to piece together my brain after what can only be described as an ultimate F1 experience. We had the worst start and red flag session I have ever witnessed as a fan. I just wanted them to go half points. It was ridiculous. And then just, wow, Jensen just did so well. Start from seventh, five pit stops, a drive-through penalty, involved in two crashes, well, incidents, goes down to 21st, and then gets all the way up to first in the last 15 laps of the race. Like, wow. I actually don't know how did that even happen. Just yay.
I wish I could yay like Lou.
Just yay.
That's very sweet.
That's
I'm glad
a very
she's
happy lady.
Yes, she's almost as happy as Jensen himself.
Yes. Jensen's teammate, not so happy.
Oh, you're going down that road, are
not
you?
Not as unhappy as post-Monaco.
Are you sure you want to discuss this?
Not really, okay. But it's got to be done. So after Monaco, Hamilton, he had to apologise to the stewards for his outburst and everything. He really needed a quiet race this
weekend.
Didn't
he just? Yes, he did. He needed to keep his head down and to get the results in. The opposite of that happened.
Yeah.
Not a great qualifying. Again, Lewis thought he was going to do well. I think McLaren may have earmarked this race as a race where they had a chance of beating Red Bull. And Red Bull were on the defensive in terms of their expectations.
Well, they kept saying, this is not our circuit, we're going to do rubbish, even though they qualified on pole and led most of the race.
McLaren's pace absolutely disappeared in qualifying. When it mattered the most, there was no pace there. So Lewis Hamilton would have been frustrated, understandably, for the second race in a row. However, the way he started the Grand Prix was worrying.
Clearly, he was frustrated and just feels the need to make it all up as soon as possible. And you kind of feel like in this year, you don't need to go all out straight away. Mm. It's not all about the first corner anymore.
Not at all. It used to be. I can completely understand it. When Lewis came into Formula One, it was all about the first corner of the first lap.
Yeah.
However, his first corner of this lap, he punted Webber off the track. And that's where the fun began. I think in the comments I said something along the lines of, Lewis appears to be driving this race like it's a three-lap sprint. However, it wasn't even that for him, as he managed to take off Jensen almost on, it was on the next lap or within the next few laps.
Yeah.
It was all over. What was your take on that accident?
I have zero take on that accident. I'm staying right on the fence.
Really?
Yep.
You genuinely think it was 50-50?
No, I have no opinion.
Oh, you don't care?
Well, no, I only saw it a couple of times because I am not one to sit and review footage over and over again and try and apportion blame because
60
generally
times.
It's to me
60 times I've seen that pass.
To me, it looked like just an irregular racing incident. So get over it. The only interesting thing is that it was between teammates. I mean, Button, I don't know whether he saw that Hamilton was there or not, but he was taking the racing line. I do think that the driver behind needs to take a bit more responsibility because he can see everything. And if you are behind, It's your mission to try and get past.
I think, again, this was another long-running discussion. We had a discussion about this in the side podcast comments. It went on for something like 2.5 hours. It was a heated and involved debate. My final reasoning behind it, I blame Lewis 99%. I think David Germain in GP Plus claimed it was Button's fault, which is stretching the truth a little, I think. I have watched the replay a lot of times.
60, you said?
Yeah, but it must be. Yeah, it's getting on for that. I mean, I've seen every angle. I've seen every snapshot, every photograph, every bit of footage. As far as I can tell, Jenson Button took the line he always was going to take. He took the racing line, and he never deviated from that at all. I don't think he had any idea that Lewis was there. If we knew Lewis was there, that would make him as bad as Michael Schumacher in Hungary, yeah. It would make him... I mean, it would mean that the Jenson Button tried to kill his teammate by ramming him into the wall. And I don't think Jenson Button tried to kill his teammate.
That seems unlikely, but I don't know if you can go that far. Was Hamilton even that far up? It didn't seem like he was...
No, it was very similar to the move on Maldonado in Monaco, whereby he managed to get his front wheel alongside the rear wheel. And that was about it. And at that point, that isn't your corner. That isn't your line. That, you know, you don't have that room. And Jenson Button took the line that anybody else would have been expected to take. And leading up to it, regardless of whose fault the accident was, leading up to it, Lewis was driving like a liability. He was driving like he was just out to pass everybody that moved, regardless whether or not it was the right time to make that move.
Yeah, and coming on the back of everything that happened in Monaco, it's just
exact opposite of what he should have been doing.
A couple of bad weeks, and it's not showing him up in a good light. And it's not a surprise that there are all these rumours suddenly starting about Hamilton leaving McLaren and going to other teams and stuff. Whatever truth there is in those, but it seems like he is getting less and less settled at his own team and really not fitting in as he used to.
I can see Lewis's plan. Every time he has a bad race, every time he does something stupid, he just has to go and have a chat with Christian Horner, and Whitmarsh will be fine. It's fine. Come back, Lewis. We love you, really. That's I think, is the plan. Every time it goes badly for Lewis, he's going to sneak into the Red Bull office for 5 minutes and make sure somebody notices him doing it, have a cup of tea, come back out. All is forgiven at McLaren. That may be his plan. I don't know. I could see... Can you see him at Red Bull? Can you see that working?
No, I can't see it at all, especially not with Vettel.
Not with Team Marco. I mean, it's not Vettel's team. It's Helmut Marco's team, and he loves Sebastian Vettel. I can't see him acknowledging Lewis any more than he fails to acknowledge Mike Webber.
I have noticed that recently Lewis has... He seems to have changed his attitude towards the team when he speaks to the media and stuff, because when he won his championship and before that, when he first started and everything, it was all, you know, win together, lose together, we're all in it together, the guys at the factory, they're all brilliant. But now, it seems more and more that he will say, they called me in, they wanted me to retire, they've made the wrong call, this is just not on. I'm doing my best out here. Everyone else is rubbish. Just seems weird.
Yes.
It doesn't seem like him at all. I don't really understand.
Felipe Massa said after the race in Monaco that the FIA need to come down hard on Lewis Hamilton, or he's going to keep doing it. And he's crashed into more cars than the Blues Brothers in the past three races. So maybe Massa's onto something.
Let's have another voicemail then. This is from Jordan, who is in Canada, although I don't think he went to the race.
Pitch Side Podcast, this is Jordan calling. Formula One in Canada, woohoo, finally a normal time to watch a race instead of PVRing races. And first off, I must say, since last time I called in, which was about Malaysia, China, Ferrari has been making big strides to get up the field. I think we've saw it this weekend especially. Alonso second, Massa third. It's great to see Felipe up there, especially what he's been going through the past year or so, trying to get back on track after his injury. Great to see that performance. I think Ferrari's really starting to make a big push here. Vettel's on the pole. I forgot to say that because I think all of us should expect that. I think we've entered the Sebastian Vettel era. And I was thinking that after the first couple of races this year. I'm pretty certain Vettel's going to win the rest of the races this year. I mean, the Red Bull is that good. And you've seen McLaren when Hamilton won in China. They have the pace too. But I think it's clear that Ferrari has paced back. You look at Felipe Massa, who was third. Mark Webber was fourth, 0.2 seconds up. And you look at Alonso, 0.3. I say good strides for Ferrari.
Ferrari, yes. We haven't spoken about those yet.
They did seem to be doing a lot better in qualifying, second and third.
because McLaren didn't do as well as everybody expected them to be doing. But yeah, good. Jordan's raised a good point. That's a great comeback they've made thus far.
Seems like they
needs a bit more
in the right direction, at least.
Absolutely, yeah. And Alonso seems happier because of it.
Yeah.
He was very stressed out when the car wasn't fast, and now he seems happier.
Although I say in the right direction, in the race, Alonso ended up pointing in the wrong direction.
That was all Button's fault.
Yeah.
Button Hamiltoned him. That's what happened there. That's exactly what happened. Button had his front wheel barely alongside Alonso's rear wheel, couldn't slow the car down, and tipped Alonso into a spin. Very similar, I think, to what Hamilton did to Webber. The difference was Alonso met the wall in the curb, couldn't continue. And that was all Jensen's fault.
So both those McLaren drivers need to go back for a bit of training.
Yes. I mean, in Button's defence, it was the only majorly significant incident he's had recently, whereas his teammates had one every lap.
Yeah.
That's the only difference. I would say I don't understand what the deal was between the McLaren drivers both doing two fast laps under the safety car at the beginning. You know, they got the penalty for going too fast. Never got fully explained. And no one, even after the race, no amount of analysis has explained that one to me. But back to Ferrari. What about Massa? I thought Massa did really, really well until he came across Naren Kartikeyan driving like an idiot. I read after the race an interview with the idiot. And apparently, according to Adam Cooper, Naren Kartikeyan came out of his pits with new tyres on, and he thought he was on Inters, and the team had put slicks on his tyres.
Did they do that on purpose, or was that a mistake?
I don't know whether it was a mistake or not, but what I do not understand is if you're sitting in a Formula One car and you watch a guy to your left and a guy to your right bolt new tyres onto your car, when you're at a standstill.
Well, maybe he wasn't watching. I mean, the pit stops.
What the hell was he looking at?
The pit stops are so fast. It's like 2 seconds. What's the point in taking your eyes off the lollipop?
Okay, but the car, the tyres are clearly marked.
Yeah.
Even inside the car, you can see the Pirelli colour stripes, right?
Yeah.
Surely you can look at those and tell. Maybe he needs the rainbow song. Maybe Noreen needs to learn those tyre colours. I don't know how you can get out of the pits and into corner three and suddenly realise you're on a different set of tyres to what you thought you were on.
The pit lane is usually quite slippery as well, so I think you would know almost instantly.
He be that clueless? I don't know. Naren said he didn't know what tyres he was on. He was on a funny line because he thought he was on Inters, but actually he was on slicks. And therefore, Massa had to abruptly move aside to avoid him and accidentally spun into the wall, which was a shame for Massa because he looked to be on for good points.
Yeah, but if that hadn't happened, then we wouldn't have had the photo finish. So,
well, that's true. Yeah, I did love the photo finish. Mm. Point taken. Yay for Naren? No.
No.
Hello, Figgy here. Race review of Canada. Right, I'm going to keep it simple today. Whoa. That was awesome. Jensen? That was awesome. Did I mention how awesome it was? But yes, it was awesome. That's all I have to say about Canada, I'm afraid. It was quite good. Okay, thank you. Bye.
That's pretty much the race covered, I think. We've just got a few bits of our usual race admin to do. For instance, Stephen has his one word on Paul de Resta.
Robbed.
Was he robbed?
The penalty was harsh.
He did think the penalty was harsh, didn't he, afterwards?
And he has been the voice of reason this season. And as the television cameras didn't pick up on it, and did I even see the incident, or did I just see him finishing the wall? I can't say that I saw it in any great detail. I certainly haven't seen it 60 times. I may not have seen it once. So therefore, I cannot disagree with that. Fair enough, he could have been robbed.
So rating the race. Now, I wrote the blog post that accompanies this little feature already. So we've had a lot of people's feedback on this race. And it seems to be a bit of a mixed bag. Lots of people thought it was the best race ever. But also, some think it's tainted by, obviously, the red flag period. Now, when the Monaco thing happened, we did say that you had to take the thing as a whole.
Right. When we reviewed the Monaco race, we took it with the red flag at the end.
Yeah.
We took that into account.
Because so it was a great race up to the red flag, then it was not so good. This was the other way around. But you still have to take the thing as a whole. So that means basically rating 4 hours worth of racing and non-racing.
Okay, you go first.
Well, I find it tricky because obviously, like I said, I didn't see everything in intricate detail. But I did like what I saw after the red flag. And it's great that we had an interesting ending and not Vettel winning. So that stirred up the championship a little bit. I'm going to have to say 5.
Five.
Yeah, because the red flag thing did ruin it for me. It meant that we couldn't watch it as we wanted to, but the rest of it made up for it. It would have been a lot lower had it never restarted again.
Okay. I think this race makes a very strong argument for shorter Formula One races in general, because the shortened race, once it got going, was fantastic, and it was long enough.
It was, 25 laps less.
Yeah, and that, to me, was the perfect length race. So if we're going to have more races next season, maybe we should have shorter races.
Oh, that's an idea.
That might work. So as a benchmark for the ideal length Grand Prix, I think Canada hit the nail on the head. So that's definitely a plus point. However, there is no point, as I said before, having a two-hour limit if you're not going to stick to a two-hour limit. And because of the two-hour limit, we missed the end, which then messed up my plans on Wednesday. So I spent far too long this week watching Formula One. From my point of view, the red flag period was desperately, desperately awful. I think it paints Formula One in a bad light, because if you wanted to, if you're in the UK and you wanted to watch the Antiques Roadshow, you couldn't, because Formula One just ran right across it.
Got in your way. But even Sandy earlier in his voicemail was saying that they were going to leave. They were gone. They were halfway out the door before it suddenly stopped raining and came back.
Thank goodness it saved itself with the final lap showdown. Jenson Button, Sebastian Vettel, they saved that Grand Prix.
So,
single-handedly.
Rate it. Stop procrastinating. You do this every time.
I'm going to give it a four.
A four.
A four, because the red flag period was too long. And if you've got David Coulthard and Martin Brundle discussing the red-backed Blackbird, it all went a bit test match special, and that's not what we tune into Formula One for. If we wanted that, we would just tune into cricket.
I did have, this seems like an opportune moment to read an email that I had from Mark in Ireland, who says, "Dear Cyplecast, a few weeks ago I emailed Cyplecast saying that the Monaco Grand Prix will be the best race of the season no matter what happened. Well, I know when I get my predictions wrong. Looking at the Canadian race go down to the wire and finally seeing Vettel cracking under immense pressure for Button was truly a great race to watch, apart from the long red flag, which was a bit boring. Also, the Brundle and Coulthard commentary is working so well together. Best quote was from David, 'Do birds have shoulders?'" And that's from Mark. Was that his best quote?
There were some crackers. They came together.
They sounded crackers.
They came together as a commentary pairing. I think that was the making of those two in the commentary box. It worked very well. I was in stitches at various points throughout it. So, plus points to them.
And we have to do our driver of the day.
Easy.
Is it? Go on.
Easy. No, you go first. Mine's too easy.
Okay. It's obvious, is it?
Absolutely. I want you to go first. See what you got.
I don't know. I don't think I'm qualified to judge,
right,
to be honest. Okay. So what I'm going to say is the driver who I saw the most of,
yes,
and that is Bernd Mailander.
Right, he's your driver of the day.
Him in that safety car.
He didn't go offline. He didn't crash into anybody else. He didn't knock his teammate out.
No. Nope.
All credit to him. I will raise you, Bernd Mailander, with the guy driving the truck that was clearing the track.
No.
That guy, you know, the little buggy, the slow thing that was going along cleaning the drains, creating wakes in his path.
They had some awesome ways of clearing the track. I mean, first there was the guys with the brushes, which is not quite so awesome, but I admire their stubbornness, really, because they're brushing and it's just filling up behind them as they go.
Yes, they're brushing water off of an island into the sea.
And they had the little sweeper things, and they also had like this massive steamroller thing, which I didn't understand how that could possibly work, but it went past and it left a dry line behind it. So
that was very good work from those guys. So all of those people should be driver of the day. I didn't understand what the red Mercedes was that was going the wrong way around the track.
There was a safety car that wasn't really a safety car. It was red.
But I think he could also, the guy in there could also get the driver of the day.
If we knew who it was.
Yeah, we can't really award that to him. Are you really not going to give us your driver of the day? I'm not going to pick anybody out of that.
I genuinely don't have one. I'm sorry.
Not even Kobayashi for getting where he got to in the first half. The first bit of the race you saw.
Yeah.
That was good.
But he got to where he got to and he did very well.
Why not
pit? Equally, it's because he didn't pit.
Yes.
So.
Track position was everything. He just stayed out and stayed where he was. Fine. Okay, my driver of the day, Michael Schumacher.
What?
Okay, Jenson Button at one point during the race was last. He was last in the race and he came from last place to first place. That doesn't happen in Formula One. That's Hollywood script stuff. No guy is last in the race halfway through it and takes it on the third from last corner of the last lap. That doesn't happen. So yay for Jenson Button. However, you cannot discount the fact that he was last because he knocked Fernando Alonso off track. Jenson Button had a fantastic afternoon, but it wasn't the driver of the day. Michael Schumacher was the driver of the day. He did very, very well. And I think he spooked his teammate. I think Nico Rosberg
the werewolf.
The werewolf has been put on the back foot for the first time since Michael Schumacher came back. And we know Michael is fantastic in the wet, and we know he can outdrive any car in that situation. And he did really well in that Mercedes. But regardless of the fact that he was in whatever second place and ended up in fourth place, what was important to me is that he had the measure of Nico Rosberg pretty much all weekend.
And it came on the back of a really amazing video piece on the BBC build-up. He and David Coulthard did a track walk that just, I mean, it was brilliant. It was hilarious. I linked to it in the, he got points for it in Christine's rankings.
Right.
Last week.
So. Deservedly so. I think you gave him 10 points, which to my mind was excessive. But it was worth...
Says the man who's given him driver of the day.
It was worth Michael Schumacher coming back solely for that track guide. I think Maverick said in the vote earlier this week for driver of the day, I think he gave it to Michael Schumacher, and he said Michael Schumacher's comeback was justified because of him giving the driver of the day. I'm giving Michael Schumacher the driver of the day. The comeback, however disastrous it has been worth it for Canada.
We'll just finish off this segment with an email from Rolando, who said off the race, "Wow, a bit of a slow start, but what a welcome change from what was becoming the parade of Vettel. I do agree that the racing has been gripping this season, but we still have the dilemma of an uncatchable Red Bull at the front. Everyone in the top five or so has been able to get close, but it's not working. DRS, Kers and tyres seem to only make the racing interesting for the rest. Red Bull, for Vettel, seems to be continuously two steps up on quali pace and half a step up on race pace. Even with the spectacle of this year's racing, I'm still left with much to be desired at the top of the podium. Jensen is not my favourite driver, but I must give him a tremendous slap on the back for dethroning Vettel. Another driver on my not-the-favourites list is Schumacher, and he was just about the best I've seen him in years today. Bravo to him. Great show as always. On to Valencia. Maybe another circuit to be awakened by the new rules."
The new rules don't come into play until Silverstone, if we're talking about the diffuser, and that might unseat Red Bull. Maybe. Or maybe not. We'll watch this space.
We've heard lots of feedback already about the Canadian Grand Prix. Ian, who contacted us via the contact form, cyclepodcast.com/about, and he had some ideas for some rule changes for the Canadian GP ahead of the race happening. He said, "Hi there, I thought of some rule changes for the Canadian GP that I think would make the sport more interesting. I'm considering submitting these to the FIA, but I thought I'd run them through your expertise first. Firstly, I think that on Friday, Vettel should just be allowed to drive his 70 laps, then they can give him the trophy and send him home. Because that's all that's going to happen anyway. Then they can let Hamilton go round for a bit and he can overtake as many imaginary ridiculous drivers as he wants and they can't get in his way. Then he can be led to a room where he can say stupid things in private and he can't get in trouble. Michael Schumacher will be racing in a bumper car so he can crash into as many people as he likes, while the two Williams will not be allowed to use their front wings because they have taken enough strain this season and deserve a break. It's not like they could go any slower anyways. And the safety car will be allowed to race as well so that poor burned Mylander can have something to do. He must have run out of DVDs to watch by now." And that's from Ian of the gloriously wet Republic of South Africa.
Wow, burned Mylander has more than enough to do next.
Some of those actually sort of came into effect. Burned has a lot to do. Schumacher, he didn't crash into anybody, so he did a lot better.
Him and Lewis tackled during the only lap that him and Lewis were near each other on. Mm. What a surprise.
Suggestions for anything, really. Feedback, any thoughts you have about Formula One are always very welcome. You can call us 01212887225 and leave us a voicemail, or find us on Skype under the username SciPodcast. You can send me an email, christine@scipodcast.com, or you can find the contact form, which is on scipodcast.com/about.
Which is the best place for it. Before we wrap up the feedback section, I have one more plug to give, and that is to Badger GP. That's the recently renamed F1 Badger. They host sporting events, Formula One get-togethers, in order to watch the race. So at the, I think it's the Sports Cafe in London, Formula One fans can all converge on the venue. They and Badger have put up a big screen TV, they've got drinks, and they've got all sorts of fun and games and interactive stuff to get you into the vibe of the Grand Prix. I think they did it for Brazil last year, and they did one for Canada this year. It sounded like it was a hoot. There was, you know, lots and lots of Formula One fans turned up, and I think from the feedback I've seen, all of them had a good time despite the red flag delay.
Well, imagine, I mean, you know, what you're going to sit in a pub, mm-hmm, while there's a red flag with other Formula One fans. That sounds terrible.
It sounds like a terrible idea with people coming to your table and offering you drinks.
Yeah, this just sounds awful.
I think they may have the answer to Formula One's problems, actually. Yeah. If we could have been there and we could have, you know, sat and got involved in that, then it wouldn't have been a problem.
It would have been a much more interesting red flag period.
There is lots of information. I think we were going to try and play some of the audio on this show, but Badger's given us a whole bunch of pictures and a load of videos, none of which work on an audio podcast, so we can't really use those. There will be a link in the show notes, though, and they've got lots of stuff on their website.
Are they doing more then, or is it just select things every now and again?
I don't know what their plans are. I think they're going to be at Silverstone, so I don't think they've got anything going on for that race. But when we have more, there was a blog post on Side Podcast promoting the event prior to it, so keep an eye on Side Podcast and we'll let you know if there's any more. It sounds like a really, really, really good idea. Because you can imagine how cool that is. Loads and loads of Formula One fans getting together. Massive HD screen, loads of drinks flowing, lots of fun and games. I think they had the first one they did in Brazil, I think someone from Virgin came down and did a talk, and there were some other motorsport people there this time. So it's very professional, it's very cool, and you must go if you're in London and you want to watch a Formula One race with other fans.
I bet they didn't end up talking about Bird's shoulders.
No, I'm sure it was much more enjoyable. In hindsight, I blooming well wish I was there.
Housekeeping. We have two bits of housekeeping this week, and they're both massive.
Massive?
Well,
in size, physically,
no,
large.
They've been the culmination of months and months and months of work.
That's what a massive.
And they both came out at the same time, which is bad planning.
Terrible planning. It's hard to give the correct amount of devotion to each one when they're overlapping in such a way. But let's start with the first one. What came out first?
F1 Minute, you know, that little 60-second podcast that I do.
I've heard of it.
You can find it at f1minute.com. Rounds up the latest F1 news stories in just brief little chunks. You can find an app for that.
There's an app for that?
Yeah.
Finally. Yeah. We've taken our time getting into making apps, but it's a first attempt at seeing whether or not that kind of thing might work for what we do. And so far, it's been well received.
People seem to like it. At the moment, it's very, very simple. The podcasts appear in the app.
Yes.
And that's all you need.
It only works on your iPhone. We're looking into making it work on an iPad.
It works on an iPad. It's just small.
Yes. An iPad, an optimized version for the iPad and also for Android devices,
be they
phones or tablets.
A lot of love for Android, so that might be in the works.
A lot of requests. I think we've had a good number of downloads. We're going to see what the take-up is. We're going to see if people like it. We're going to see what the feedback is for it. And if it goes down well, then maybe we'll expand on it and do more.
Yep, and we might also find other things that fit the app model.
Well, we have plenty of ideas.
Yep.
It just depends on whether or not anybody is actually interested in buying it and using it and you know, making the most of it. Because websites are very easy to do. You can make a website and people just sort of turn up to them and they're easy to promote. It's very hard to promote an app. It's very hard to get people to download them and to use them and to remember that they're there. So there's a lot of work to be done in that area. But I think so far, the reaction has been good. If you're listening to this podcast and you haven't been to the website and you don't know anything about it, there will be a link in the show notes. But you can search iTunes for F1 Minute, one word, and it'll pop up there, a little app. You can buy it and you can download
it's
it.
It's 59p in the UK.
And it's something. It's
99 cents, maybe.
99 cents
something
in the
like
US.
That.
It's available, I think, in all territories, whatever your local iTunes store is. Give it a shot. Tell us what you think. I mean, 59p is basically nothing. I'm sure most people can afford 59 pence to have a look and give us some feedback and let us know what you think of it. I should also mention that, you remember the world's most polite flame war that we had with another
yes.
F1 podcast recently? And they were asking for comments and likes on the iTunes store. And we rubbished that concept because we don't bother checking them anymore for our podcasts. But I wouldn't mind some iTunes feedback.
No. You did check a couple of times.
A bit of a come down. I appreciate, and yes, another F1 podcast were right, and yes, I'm wrong, and now I'm feeling slightly embarrassed about it, but if you were to review the app on iTunes, we probably would read it, regardless of what country.
Did you know Bassani renamed it the Lame War?
The Lame War?
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but I like that. It turns out I've lost the Lame War, and another F1 podcast were correct. And actually, I wouldn't mind some comments, and I wouldn't mind. I would check them. If you took the time and the trouble to leave a comment about the F1 Minute
iTunes
app,
review.
An iTunes review about the F1 Minute app, I would be almost guaranteed to check it. Feedback is very important in this. Numbers is important. The more people who download it, the more likely we're going to put effort into it in the future.
Although F1 Minute is sort of my thing, I write the shows, I record the shows, I do that. Making of the app was much more your thing, and that took up a lot of your time.
It's been about 6 months worth of effort.
You've been very, very busy. So whilst you've been doing that, I kept myself busy too.
And what were you keeping yourself busy with?
I sort of wrote a book.
As you do.
Yeah, it just happened.
You're now a published author.
That seems to have happened too, yeah.
Oh, yes. Are you proud of that title?
It's yeah.
Are you gonna rewrite your passport now?
Published author.
Mm.
Maybe, you never know. So on the site, occasionally, we did this on this day thing, and it only happened 5 or 6 times across a couple of years.
That's a nice feature, though.
Yeah, we picked out something that happened on that day and just looked at it, and it usually tied in with something that was happening in the news anyway.
Mm.
And this idea was sort of reverberating around my brain, and suddenly I came up with this idea for a book where there was a story for every day of the year.
Now, there are so many stories. It's more than one book. It's a series.
It's a two-part book. It's called That'll Be the Day, 365 F1 Stories, and it's available on the Kindle. Part one is available now, and that goes from the 1st of January to the 30th of June.
Okay.
And part two will be coming at some point soon.
And we should expand on the fact it's only an ebook. It's only available in digital form. This will never end up on paper.
Unless anyone prints it out.
If you choose to buy it and print it, that's your own problem. It's your own. No
yes.
reason to stop you doing that. You are crazy, though. It's not. We are done with physical books. I'm not sure I ever see myself buying a physical paperback book ever again.
Well, the last one we bought was we bought Joe's books, and we've bought Stuart Codling's books, which are more like big coffee table art books.
And that's the last time we. That's the last. It may well be the last book we ever buy.
Yeah.
We're all about the digital, and this book is optimized for digital usage. It's been designed solely. To be used in a Kindle or on an e-reader of some e-device of some description. It will never see a printer. It will never be professionally typeset in that respect. It's not designed to do that. It's all about the future of digital print.
And that is brilliant, because we posted a quick post about it saying, buy this book, it's brilliant, as everyone should do. And I put a link in the Facebook account, and someone commented in there, well, this is amazing. 10 minutes ago I saw this thing, and I've got the book and I'm reading it.
And it's worth saying, you know what, it feels a bit like when we started Side Podcast, all these things we've got coming out at the moment, because when we started Side Podcast, we were really excited to see if anybody would subscribe and really excited to see if anyone would download it. And it's the same with the app, and it's the same with the book. And we're like, wouldn't it be now, right now we're thinking, my God, wouldn't it be amazing if we ever sold 100 apps, or wouldn't it be amazing if you ever sold 100 books? Wouldn't that be really cool?
Yeah.
And that's so old school and so like what it used to be when, you know, you're trying
what
something new.
What will people
new.
Think?
It's brand new, and you don't know how it's going to be received. And much like podcasting, when we started, it was like, well, this is a podcast, and this is how you listen to a podcast. And everybody can listen to a podcast. We just have to explain how to do it. With ebooks, we're in exactly the same situation. If you can read Side Podcast, if you can download Side Podcast, you can read this book. Amazon make a bunch of apps for your phone, for your tablet, for your notebook, for your PC.
Yeah.
Whatever machine you've got, whatever electronic device you've got, you can read this ebook.
I think we need to do another post with some better instructions, because we used to do posts saying this is how you listen to a podcast. We need another post. You read my book.
We're not that early to the game. We weren't that early to the podcasting game, really, but it's early enough that people still need some direction. It's not this unobtainable thing that, you know, you can't get into. No one's being excluded here. You can buy it anywhere in the world. Anybody can do it. Anybody can sign up. If you've never read an ebook before, this might be the ebook to get you started.
The thing I like about my book, which is a weird thing
you
to say.
You can say that.
Yeah.
Is that, to like it too.
It's that it's because there's a story for each day. So it's very easy to dip in and out of. You could just look at what happened on this day, although this day would actually be in part two, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Hmm.
If you've never read an ebook before, you don't have to sit down and read from start to finish. You can just dip in and out, and it's a good introduction.
It's a great introduction. I think it's... in both of these cases, I think we've underpriced them, because we're still trying to learn, you know, we're learning a lot about costs and expenses and that kind of thing, and the value of what we do, because we've never done it before. Side Podcast, we've always given everything away effectively. So we've got stuff to learn in that area. But I think it's comparatively a cheap ebook, and not to devalue the content, but just the way we've priced it at the moment. And maybe in the future we might adjust it. So if you're an early adopter, this is a great way to get into ebooks, and you'll get yourself a bargain.
Yeah, we will link to everything in the show notes. And there was a post recently on Side Podcast about the book. So if you searched for That'll Be the Day or 365 Stories.
Kindle is a good thing.
You can search on Amazon. And also, if you can't find it anywhere, if you get completely lost, you can also go to my personal website, which is mrschristine.com/books. And you can find all the links you need there too.
I would like to say a special mention to anybody who's bought it so far, because in the first week of publication, you outsold both Eddie Jordan's personal biography, which made me quite happy.
Yeah.
And also Ben Collins's biography, and that made me very happy.
Well, I know for a fact that Alison bought it specifically because at the time I was behind Eddie and she didn't want that to happen.
Good. if you have, you know, if you don't like Eddie Jordan for any reason, you don't like Ben Collins for any reason, buy Christine's book, because it will make them drop down a place and raise her above them. And who out there doesn't want to say that Christine is better than Eddie Jordan? If that's not a good enough reason to buy it, I don't know what is. You know it makes sense.
I think that's it for this show. It's bound to be another long show, just
it's
like the race.
It's going to be a record-breaking one. We like short shows. It's not happening at the moment.
No.
What's coming up? Maybe it's going to be a quiet race. What's next?
We're in Valencia next. F1 turns up to Valencia for the European Grand Prix.
Looking forward to that.
Well, it's going to be interesting because obviously it's no big secret that Valencia has produced boring races. So it will be interesting to see what tyres and all that jazz can do.
We get to see what the new regulations bring to the Valencia party. One thing it won't fix is it's still going to look like a dockyard.
Oh, the green building.
That's the highlight of the race.